Chapter 9. A Much-Needed Gap.
What can be more soul-shaking than peering through a 100-inch telescope at a distant galaxy? Holding a 100-million-year-old fossil or a 500,000-year-old stone tool in one's hand. Standing before the immense chasm of space and time that is the Grand Canyon, or listening to a scientist who gazed upon the face of the universe's creation and did not blink. That is deep and sacred science. Michael Shermer.
This book fills a much-needed gap. The jest works because we simultaneously understand the two opposite meanings. Incidentally, I thought it was an invented witticism, but to my surprise, I find that it has actually been used in all innocence by a publisher whose website advertises a book that fills a much-needed gap in the literature available on the post-structuralist movement. It seems deliciously appropriate that this avowedly superfluous book is all about Michel Foucault, Roland Barthes, Julia Kristeva, and other icons of haute francophonism.
Does religion fill a much-needed gap? It is often said that there is a God-shaped gap in the brain which needs to be filled. We have a psychological need for God, imaginary friend, father, big brother, confessor, confidant, and the need has to be satisfied whether God really exists or not. But could it be that God clutters up a gap that we'd be better off filling with something else? Science, perhaps, art, human friendship, humanism, love of this life in the real world, giving no credence to other lives beyond the grave, a love of nature, or what the great entomologist E.O. Wilson has called biophilia.
Religion has at one time or another been thought to fill four main roles in human life: explanation, exhortation, consolation, and inspiration. Historically, religion aspired to explain our own existence and the nature of the universe in which we find ourselves. In this role, it is now completely superseded by science, and I've dealt with it in Chapter 4. By exhortation, I mean moral instruction on how we ought to behave, and I covered that in other chapters. I have not so far done justice to consolation and inspiration, and this final chapter will briefly deal with them. As a preliminary to consolation itself, I want to begin with the childhood phenomenon of the imaginary friend, which I believe has affinities with religious belief. Binker. Christopher Robin, I presume, did not believe that Piglet and Winnie the Pooh really spoke to him. But was Binker different?
Binker, what I call him, is a secret of my own, and Binker is the reason why I never feel alone. Playing in the nursery, sitting on the stair, whatever I'm busy at, Binker will be there. Oh, Daddy is clever, he's a clever sort of man, and Mummy is the best since the world began, and Nanny is Nanny, and I call her Nan. But they can't see Binker. Binker's always talking, because I'm teaching him to speak. He sometimes likes to do it in a funny sort of squeak, and he sometimes likes to do it in a hoodling sort of roar, and I have to do it for him because his throat is rather sore. Oh, Daddy is clever. He's a clever sort of man. And Mummy knows all that anybody can, and Nanny is Nanny, and I call her Nan. But they don't know Binker. Binker's brave as lions when we're running in the park. Binker's brave as tigers when we're lying in the dark. Binker's brave as elephants. He never, never cries, except like other people when the soap gets in his eyes. Oh, Daddy is Daddy. He's a Daddy sort of man, and Mummy is as Mummy as anybody can, and Nanny is Nanny, and I call her Nan, but they're not like Binker. Binker isn't greedy, but he does like things to eat, so I have to say to people when they're giving me a sweet, "Oh, Binker wants a chocolate, so could you give me two?" And then I eat it for him, because his teeth are rather new. Well, I'm very fond of Daddy, but he hasn't time to play, and I'm very fond of Mummy, but she sometimes goes away, and I'm often cross with Nanny when she wants to brush my hair. But Binker's always Binker, and is certain to be there. A.A. Milne, Now We Are Six.
Is the imaginary friend phenomenon a higher illusion in a different category from ordinary childhood make-believe? My own experience is not much help here. Like many parents, my mother kept a notebook of my childish sayings. in addition to simple pretendings, now I'm the man in the moon, an accelerator, a Babylonian, I was evidently fond of second-order pretendings, now I'm an owl pretending to be a water wheel, which might be reflexive, now I'm a little boy pretending to be Richard. I never once believed I really was any of those things, and I think that is normally true of childhood make-believe games. But I didn't have a binker. If the testimony of their adult selves is to be believed, at least some of those normal children who have imaginary friends really do believe they exist, and in some cases see them as clear and vivid hallucinations. I suspect that the binker phenomenon of childhood may be a good model for understanding theistic belief in adults. I do not know whether psychologists have studied it from this point of view, but it would be a worthwhile piece of research. Companion and confidant, a binker for life, that is surely one role that God plays, one gap that might be left if God were to go. Another child, a girl, had a little purple man who seemed to her a real and visible presence and who would manifest himself, sparkling out of the air, with a gentle tinkling sound. He visited her regularly, especially when she felt lonely, but with decreasing frequency as she grew older. On a particular day, just before she went to kindergarten, the little purple man came to her, heralded by his usual tinkling fanfare, and announced that he would not be visiting her any more. This saddened her, but the little purple man told her that she was getting bigger now and wouldn't need him in the future. He must leave her now so that he could look after other children. He promised her that he would come back to her if she ever really needed him. He did return to her many years later in a dream, when she had a personal crisis and was trying to decide what to do with her life. The door of her bedroom opened, and a cartload of books appeared, pushed into the room by the little purple man. She interpreted this as advice that she should go to university, advice that she took and later judged to be good. The story makes me almost tearful, and it brings me as close as I shall probably come to understanding the consoling and counseling role of imaginary gods in people's lives. A being may exist only in the imagination, yet still seem completely real to the child, and still give real comfort and good advice. Perhaps even better, imaginary friends and imaginary gods have the time and patience to devote all their attention to the sufferer, and they are much cheaper than psychiatrists or professional counsellors.
Did gods, in their role as consolers and counsellors, evolve from binkers by a sort of psychological pedomorphosis? Pedomorphosis is the retention into adulthood of childhood characteristics. Pekingese dogs have pedomorphic faces. The adults look like puppies. It is a well-known pattern in evolution, widely accepted as important for the development of such human characteristics as our bulbous forehead and short jaws. Evolutionists have described us as juvenile apes, and it is certainly true that juvenile chimpanzees and gorillas look more like humans than adult ones do. Could religions have evolved originally by gradual postponement over generations of the moment in life when children gave up their binkers, just as we slowed down during evolution the flattening of our foreheads and the protrusion of our jaws? It might be better to see both gods and binkers as byproducts of the same psychological predisposition. Both have the power to comfort and provide a vivid sounding board for trying out ideas. Consolation. It is time to face up to the important role that God plays in consoling us, and the humanitarian challenge, if he does not exist, to put something in his place. Many people who concede that God probably doesn't exist, and that he is not necessary for morality, still come back with what they often regard as a trump card, the alleged psychological or emotional need for a God. If you take religion away, people truculently ask, what are you going to put in its place? What have you to offer the dying patients, the weeping bereaved, the lonely Eleanor Rigbys, for whom God is their only friend?
The first thing to say in response to this is something that should need no saying. Religion's power to console doesn't make it true. Even if we make a huge concession, even if it were conclusively demonstrated that belief in God's existence is completely essential to human psychological and emotional well-being, even if all atheists were despairing neurotics driven to suicide by relentless cosmic angst, none of this would contribute the tiniest jot or tittle of evidence that religious belief is true. It might be evidence in favour of the desirability of convincing yourself that God exists, even if he doesn't. In any case, my hypothetical concession was extravagant and wrong. I know of no evidence that atheists have any general tendency towards unhappy, angst-ridden despond. Some atheists are happy, others are miserable. Similarly, some Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists are miserable, while others are happy. There may be statistical evidence bearing on the relationship between happiness and belief, or unbelief, but I doubt if it is a strong effect one way or the other. I find it more interesting to ask whether there is any good reason to feel depressed if we live without God. I shall end this book by arguing, on the contrary, that it is an understatement to say that one can lead a happy and fulfilled life without supernatural religion. First, though, I must examine the claims of religion to offer consolation. Consolation, according to the Shorter Oxford Dictionary, is the alleviation of sorrow or mental distress. I shall divide consolation into two types.
1. Direct physical consolation. A man stuck for the night on a bare mountain may find comfort in a large, warm St. Bernard dog, not forgetting, of course, the brandy barrel around its neck. A weeping child may be consoled by the embrace of strong arms wrapped around her and reassuring words whispered in her ear. 2. Consolation by discovery of a previously unappreciated fact or a previously undiscovered way of looking at existing facts. A woman whose husband has been killed in war may be consoled by the discovery that she is pregnant by him, or that he died a hero. We can also get consolation through discovering a new way of thinking about a situation. Mark Twain's dismissal of the fear of death is another.
I do not fear death. I had been dead for billions and billions of years before I was born, and had not suffered the slightest inconvenience from it.
The aperçu changes nothing about the fact of our inevitable death, but we have been offered a different way of looking at that inevitability, and we may find it consoling.
How does religion compare with, say, science in providing these two types of consolation? Looking at type 1 consolation first, it is entirely plausible that the strong arms of God, even if they are purely imaginary, could console in just the same kind of way as the real arms of a friend, or a St. Bernard dog with a brandy cask around its neck. But, of course, scientific medicine can also offer comfort, usually more effectively than brandy. Turning now to type 2 consolation, it is easy to believe that religion could be extremely effective. People caught up in a terrible disaster, such as an earthquake, frequently report that they derive consolation from the reflection that it is all part of God's inscrutable plan. No doubt good shall come of it in the fullness of time. If someone fears death, sincere belief that he has an immortal soul can be consoling. False beliefs can be every bit as consoling as true ones, right up until the moment of disillusionment. This applies to non-religious beliefs too. A man with terminal cancer may be consoled by a doctor who lies to him that he is cured, just as effectively as another man who is told truthfully that he is cured. Sincere and wholehearted belief in life after death is even more immune to disillusionment than belief in a lying doctor. The doctor's lie remains effective only until the symptoms become unmistakable. A believer in life after death can never be ultimately disillusioned. Polls suggest that approximately 95% of the population of the United States believe they will survive their own death. I can't help wondering how many people who claim such belief really, in their heart of hearts, hold it. If they were truly sincere, shouldn't they all behave like the Abbot of Ampleforth? When Cardinal Basil Hume told him that he was dying, the abbot was delighted for him.
Congratulations! That's brilliant news! I wish I was coming with you.
The abbot, it seems, really was a sincere believer. But it is precisely because it is so rare and unexpected that his story catches our attention, almost provokes our amusement, in a fashion reminiscent of the cartoon of a young woman carrying a Make Love Not War banner, stark naked, and with a bystander exclaiming, "Now that's what I call sincerity." Why don't all Christians and Muslims say something like the abbot when they hear that a friend is dying? When a devout woman is told by the doctor that she has only months to live, why doesn't she beam with excited anticipation, as if she's just won a holiday in the Seychelles? I can't wait! Why don't faithful visitors at her bedside shower her with messages for those that have gone before? Do give my love to Uncle Robert when you see him.
Why don't religious people talk like that when in the presence of the dying? Could it be that they don't really believe all that stuff they pretend to believe?
What are we to make of the observation of a senior nurse of my acquaintance, with a lifetime's experience in running a home for old people where death is a regular occurrence? She has noticed over the years that the individuals who are most afraid of death are the religious ones. Her observation would need to be substantiated statistically, but assuming she is right, what is going on here? Whatever it is, it doesn't, on the face of it, speak strongly of religion's power to comfort the dying. In the case of Catholics, maybe they're afraid of purgatory. The saintly Cardinal Hume said farewell to a friend in these words, "Well, goodbye then. See you in purgatory, I suppose." What I suppose is that there was a sceptical twinkle in those kind old eyes. An Australian friend coined a wonderful phrase to describe the tendency for religiosity to increase in old age. Say it with an Australian intonation, going up at the end like a question. Cramming for the final?
The doctrine of purgatory offers a preposterous revelation of the way the theological mind works. Purgatory is a sort of divine Ellis Island, a Hadean waiting room where dead souls go if their sins aren't bad enough to send them to hell, but they still need a bit of remedial checking out and purifying before they can be admitted to the sin-free zone of heaven. In medieval times, the church used to sell indulgences for money. This amounted to paying for some number of days' remission from purgatory, and the church literally, and with breathtaking presumption, issued signed certificates specifying the number of days off that had been purchased. The Roman Catholic Church is an institution for whose gains the phrase ill-gotten might have been specially invented. And of all its money-making rip-offs, the selling of indulgences must surely rank among the greatest con tricks in history, the medieval equivalent of the Nigerian internet scam, but far more successful.
As recently as 1903, Pope Pius X was still able to tabulate the number of days remission from purgatory that each rank in the hierarchy was entitled to grant. Cardinals 200 days, archbishops 100 days, bishops a mere 50 days. By his time, however, indulgences were no longer sold directly for money. Even in the Middle Ages, money was not the only currency in which you could buy parole from purgatory. You could pay in prayers too, either your own before death or the prayers of others on your behalf after your death. And money could buy prayers. If you were rich, you could lay down provision for your soul in perpetuity.
But what is really fascinating about the doctrine of purgatory is the evidence that theologians have advanced for it. Evidence so spectacularly weak that it renders even more comical the airy confidence with which it is asserted. The entry on purgatory in the Catholic Encyclopedia has a section called Proofs. The essential evidence for the existence of purgatory is this. If the dead simply went to heaven or hell on the basis of their sins while on earth, there would be no point in praying for them.
For why pray for the dead if there be no belief in the power of prayer to afford solace to those who are as yet excluded from the sight of God?
And we do pray for the dead, don't we? Therefore, purgatory must exist, otherwise our prayers would be pointless. QED. This seriously is an example of what passes for reasoning in the theological mind. That remarkable non sequitur is mirrored, on a larger scale, in another common deployment of the argument from consolation. There must be a God, the argument goes, because if there were not, life would be empty, pointless, futile, a desert of meaningless and insignificance. How can it be necessary to point out that the logic falls at the first fence? Maybe life is empty. Maybe our prayers for the dead really are pointless. To presume the opposite is to presume the truth of the very conclusion we seek to prove. The alleged syllogism is transparently circular. Life without your wife may very well be intolerable, barren and empty, but this unfortunately doesn't stop her being dead. There is something infantile in the presumption that somebody else, parents in the case of children, God in the case of adults, has a responsibility to give your life meaning and point. It is all of a piece with the infantilism of those who, the moment they twist their ankle, look around for someone to sue. Somebody else must be responsible for my well-being, and somebody else must be to blame if I am hurt. Is it a similar infantilism that really lies behind the need for a God? Are we back to Binker again? The truly adult view, by contrast, is that our life is as meaningful, as full, and as wonderful as we choose to make it. And we can make it very wonderful indeed. If science gives consolation of a non-material kind, it merges into the final topic, inspiration.
Inspiration. This is a matter of taste or private judgment, which has the slightly unfortunate effect that the method of argument I must employ is rhetoric rather than logic. I've done it before, and so have many others, including, to name only recent examples, Carl Sagan in Pale Blue Dot, E.O. Wilson in Biophilia, Michael Shermer in The Soul of Science, and Paul Kurtz in Affirmations. In Unweaving the Rainbow, I tried to convey how lucky we are to be alive, given that the vast majority of people who could potentially be thrown up by the combinatorial lottery of DNA will in fact never be born. For those of us lucky enough to be here, I pictured the relative brevity of life by imagining a laser-thin spotlight creeping along a gigantic ruler of time. Everything before or after the spotlight is shrouded in the darkness of the dead past or the darkness of the unknown future. We are staggeringly lucky to find ourselves in the spotlight. However brief our time in the sun, if we waste a second of it or complain that it is dull or barren or, like a child, boring, couldn't this be seen as a callous insult to those unborn trillions who will never even be offered life in the first place? As many atheists have said better than me, the knowledge that we have only one life should make it all the more precious. The atheist view is correspondingly life-affirming and life-enhancing, while at the same time never being tainted with self-delusion, wishful thinking, or the whinging self-pity of those who feel that life owes them something. Emily Dickinson said,
"That it will never come again is what makes life so sweet."
If the demise of God will leave a gap, different people will fill it in different ways. My way includes a good dose of science, the honest and systematic endeavour to find out the truth about the real world. I see the human effort to understand the universe as a model-building enterprise. Each of us builds inside our head a model of the world in which we find ourselves. The minimal model of the world is the model our ancestors needed in order to survive in it. The simulation software was constructed and debugged by natural selection, and it is most adept in the world familiar to our ancestors on the African savannah, a three-dimensional world of medium-sized material objects moving at medium speeds relative to one another. As an unexpected bonus, our brains turn out to be powerful enough to accommodate a much richer world model than the mediocre utilitarian one that our ancestors needed in order to survive. Art and science are runaway manifestations of this bonus. Let me paint one final picture to convey the power of science to open the mind and satisfy the psyche. The mother of all burqas. One of the unhappiest spectacles to be seen on our streets today is the image of a woman swathed in shapeless black from head to toe, peering out at the world through a tiny slit. The burqa is not just an instrument of oppression of women and claustral repression of their liberty and their beauty, not just a token of egregious male cruelty and tragically cowed female submission. I want to use the narrow slit in the veil as a symbol of something else.
Our eyes see the world through a narrow slit in the electromagnetic spectrum. Visible light is a chink of brightness in the vast, dark spectrum, from radio waves at the long end to gamma rays at the short end. Quite how narrow is hard to appreciate, and a challenge to convey. Imagine a gigantic black burqa with a vision slit of approximately the standard width, say about 1 inch. If the length of black cloth above the slit represents the shortwave end of the invisible spectrum, and if the length of black cloth below the slit represents the longwave portion of the invisible spectrum, how long would the burqa have to be in order to accommodate a 1-inch slit to the same scale? It is hard to represent it sensibly without invoking logarithmic scales, so huge are the lengths we are dealing with. The last chapter of a book like this is no place to start tossing logarithms around, but you can take it that it would be the mother of all burqas. The 1-inch window of visible light is derisively tiny compared with the miles and miles of black cloth representing the invisible part of the spectrum, from radio waves at the hem of the skirt to gamma rays at the top of the head. What science does for us is widen the window. It opens up so wide that the imprisoning black garment drops away almost completely, exposing our senses to airy and exhilarating freedom. Optical telescopes use glass lenses and mirrors to scan the heavens, and what they see is stars that happen to be radiating in the narrow band of wavelengths that we call visible light. But other telescopes see in the X-ray or radio wavelengths and present to us a cornucopia of alternative night skies. On a smaller scale, cameras with appropriate filters can see in the ultraviolet and take photographs of flowers that show an alien range of stripes and spots that are visible to, and seemingly designed for, insect eyes, but which our unaided eyes can't see at all. Insect eyes have a spectral window of similar width to ours, but slightly shifted up the burqa. They are blind to red, and they see further into the ultraviolet than we do, into the ultraviolet garden. The metaphor of the narrow window of light broadening out into a spectacularly wide spectrum serves us in other areas of science. We live near the centre of a cavernous museum of magnitudes, viewing the world with sense organs and nervous systems that are equipped to perceive and understand only a small middle range of sizes, moving at a middle range of speeds. We are at home with objects ranging in size from a few kilometres, the view from a mountaintop, to about a tenth of a millimetre, the point of a pin. Outside this range, even our imagination is handicapped, and we need the help of instruments and of mathematics, which fortunately we can learn to deploy. The range of sizes, distances, or speeds with which our imaginations are comfortable is a tiny band set in the midst of a gigantic range of the possible, from the scale of quantum strangeness at the smaller end to the scale of Einsteinian cosmology at the larger.
Our imaginations are forlornly under-equipped to cope with distances outside the narrow middle range of the ancestrally familiar. We try to visualize an electron as a tiny ball in orbit around a larger cluster of balls representing protons and neutrons. That isn't what it is like at all. Electrons are not like little balls. They are not like anything we recognize. It isn't clear that like even means anything when we try to fly too close to reality's further horizons. Our imaginations are not yet tooled up to penetrate the neighbourhood of the quantum. Nothing at that scale behaves in the way matter, as we are evolved to think, ought to behave. Nor can we cope with the behaviour of objects that move at some appreciable fraction of the speed of light. Common sense lets us down, because common sense evolved in a world where nothing moves very fast and nothing is very small or very large. At the end of a famous essay on possible worlds, the great biologist J.B.S. Haldane wrote,
"Now my own suspicion is that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. I suspect that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of or can be dreamed of in any philosophy."
By the way, I'm intrigued by the suggestion that the famous Hamlet speech invoked by Haldane is conventionally misspoken. The normal stress is on your.
There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Indeed, the line is often plonkingly quoted with the implication that Horatio stands for shallow rationalists and sceptics everywhere. But some scholars place the stress on philosophy, with your almost vanishing. than are dreamt of in your philosophy. The difference doesn't really matter for present purposes, except that the second interpretation already takes care of Haldane's any philosophy. The dedicatee of this book, Douglas Adams, made a living from the strangeness of science, pushing it to the point of comedy. The following is taken from the same extempore speech in Cambridge in 1998, from which I've already quoted.
The fact that we live at the bottom of a deep gravity well, on the surface of a gas-covered planet going around a nuclear fireball 90 million miles away, and think this to be normal, is obviously some indication of how skewed our perspective tends to be.
Where other science fiction writers played on the oddness of science to arouse our sense of the mysterious, Douglas Adams used it to make us laugh. Those who've read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy might think of the infinite improbability drive, for instance. Laughter is arguably the best response to some of the stranger paradoxes of modern physics. The alternative, I sometimes think, is to cry. Quantum mechanics, that rarefied pinnacle of 20th century scientific achievement, makes brilliantly successful predictions about the real world. Richard Feynman compared its precision to predicting a distance as great as the width of North America to an accuracy of one human hair's breadth. This predictive success seems to mean that quantum theory has got to be true in some sense, as true as anything we know, even including the most down-to-earth common-sense facts. Yet the assumptions that quantum theory needs to make in order to deliver those predictions are so mysterious that even the great Feynman himself was moved to remark, there are various versions of this quotation, of which the following seems to me the neatest,
"If you think you understand quantum theory, you don't understand quantum theory."
A similar remark is attributed to Niels Bohr. Anyone who is not shocked by quantum theory has not understood it.
Quantum theory is so queer that physicists resort to one or another paradoxical interpretation of it. Resort is the right word. David Deutsch in The Fabric of Reality embraces the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory, perhaps because the worst that you can say of it is that it is preposterously wasteful. It postulates a vast and rapidly growing number of universes existing in parallel and mutually undetectable except through the narrow porthole of quantum mechanical experiments. In some of these universes, I am already dead. In a small minority of them, you have a green moustache, and so on. The alternative, Copenhagen interpretation, is equally preposterous, not wasteful, just shatteringly paradoxical. Erwin Schrödinger satirized it with his parable of the cat. Schrödinger's cat is shut up in a box with a killing mechanism triggered by a quantum mechanical event. Before we open the lid of the box, we don't know whether the cat is dead. Common sense tells us that, nevertheless, the cat must be either alive or dead inside the box. The Copenhagen interpretation contradicts common sense. All that exists before we open the box is a probability. As soon as we open the box, the wave function collapses and we are left with the single event, the cat is dead or the cat is alive. Until we opened the box, it was neither dead nor alive.
The many worlds interpretation of the same events is that in some universes the cat is dead, in other universes the cat is alive. Neither interpretation satisfies human common sense or intuition. The more macho physicists don't care. What matters is that the mathematics work and the predictions are experimentally fulfilled. Most of us are too wimpish to follow them. We seem to need some sort of visualization of what is really going on.
The biologist Lewis Wolpert believes that the queerness of modern physics is just the tip of the iceberg. Science in general, as opposed to technology, does violence to common sense. Here's a favorite example. Every time you drink a glass of water, the odds are good that you will imbibe at least one molecule that passed through the bladder of Oliver Cromwell. It's just elementary probability theory. The number of molecules per glassful is hugely greater than the number of glassfuls in the world. So every time we have a full glass, we are looking at a rather high proportion of the molecules of water that exist in the world. There is, of course, nothing special about Cromwell or bladders. Haven't you just breathed in a nitrogen atom that was once breathed out by the third iguanodon to the left of the tall cycad tree?
Aren't you glad to be alive in a world where not only is such a conjecture possible, but you are privileged to understand why? And publicly explain it to somebody else, not as your opinion or belief, but as something that they, when they've understood your reasoning, will feel compelled to accept. Maybe this is an aspect of what Carl Sagan meant when he explained his motive in writing The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark.
Not explaining science seems to me perverse. When you're in love, you want to tell the world. This book is a personal statement reflecting my lifelong love affair with science.
The evolution of complex life, indeed its very existence in a universe obeying physical laws, is wonderfully surprising. Think about it. On one planet, and possibly only one planet in the entire universe, molecules that would normally make nothing more complicated than a chunk of rock gather themselves together into chunks of rock-sized matter of such staggering complexity that they are capable of running, jumping, swimming, flying, seeing, hearing, capturing and eating other such animated chunks of complexity, capable in some cases of thinking and feeling, and falling in love with yet other chunks of complex matter. We now understand essentially how the trick is done, but only since 1859. Before 1859, it would have seemed very, very odd indeed. Now, thanks to Darwin, it is merely very odd. Darwin seized the window of the Burka and wrenched it open, letting in a flood of understanding whose dazzling novelty and power to uplift the human spirit perhaps had no precedent, unless it was the Copernican realization that the Earth was not the center of the universe.
Tell me,
the great 20th century philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein once asked a friend,
why do people always say it was natural for man to assume that the sun went round the Earth rather than that the Earth was rotating?
His friend replied,
well, obviously, because it just looks as though the sun is going round the Earth.
Wittgenstein responded,
well, what would it have looked like if it had looked as though the Earth was rotating?
I sometimes quote this remark of Wittgenstein in lectures, expecting the audience to laugh. Instead, they seem stunned into silence. I now want to pursue the point mentioned above, that the way we see the world and the reason why we find some things intuitively easy to grasp and others hard is that our brains are themselves evolved organs, onboard computers, evolved to help us survive in a world, I shall use the name Middle World, where the objects that mattered to our survival were neither very large nor very small, a world where things either stood still or moved slowly compared with the speed of light, and where the very improbable could safely be treated as impossible. Our mental Burka window is narrow because it didn't need to be any wider in order to assist our ancestors to survive. Science has taught us, against all evolved intuition, that apparently solid things like crystals and rocks are really composed almost entirely of empty space. The familiar illustration represents the nucleus of an atom as a fly in the middle of a sports stadium. The next atom is right outside the stadium. The hardest, solidest, densest rock, then, is really almost entirely empty space, broken only by tiny particles so far apart that they shouldn't count. So why do rocks look and feel solid and hard and impenetrable? I won't try to imagine how Wittgenstein might have answered that question, but as an evolutionary biologist, I would answer it like this. Our brains have evolved to help our bodies find their way around the world on the scale at which those bodies operate. We never evolved to navigate the world of atoms. If we had, our brains probably would perceive rocks as full of empty space. Rocks feel hard and impenetrable to our hands because our hands can't penetrate them. The reason they can't penetrate them is unconnected with the sizes and separations of the particles that constitute matter. Instead, it has to do with the force fields that are associated with those widely spaced particles in solid matter. It is useful for our brains to construct notions like solidity and impenetrability because such notions help us to navigate our bodies through a world in which objects, which we call solid, cannot occupy the same space as each other.
We are evolved denizens of Middle World, and that limits what we are capable of imagining. The narrow window of our burqa permits us, unless we are especially gifted or peculiarly well-educated, to see only middle world.
Steve Grand, in Creation, Life and How to Make It, is almost scathing about our preoccupation with matter itself. We have this tendency to think that only solid material things are really things at all. Waves of electromagnetic fluctuation in a vacuum seem unreal. Victorians thought that waves had to be waves in some material medium. No such medium was known, so they invented one and named it the luminiferous ether. But we find real matter comfortable to our understanding only because our ancestors evolved to survive in middle world, where matter is a useful construct. Steve Grand points out that you and I are more like waves than permanent things. He invites his reader to think
of an experience from your childhood, something you remember clearly, something you can see, feel, maybe even smell, as if you were really there. After all, you really were there at the time, weren't you? How else would you remember it? But here is the bombshell. You weren't there. Not a single atom that is in your body today was there when that event took place. Matter flows from place to place and momentarily comes together to be you. Whatever you are, therefore, you are not the stuff of which you are made. If that doesn't make the hair stand up on the back of your neck, read it again until it does, because it is important.
Really isn't a word we should use with simple confidence. If a neutrino had a brain which had evolved in neutrino-sized ancestors, it would say that rocks really do consist mostly of empty space. We have brains that evolved in medium-sized ancestors who couldn't walk through rocks, so our really is a really in which rocks are solid. Really for an animal is whatever its brain needs it to be in order to assist its survival. And because different species live in such different worlds, there will be a troubling variety of realies.
What we see of the real world is not the unvarnished real world, but a model of the real world, regulated and adjusted by sense data. A model that is constructed so that it is useful for dealing with the real world. The nature of that model depends on the kind of animal we are. A flying animal needs a different kind of world model from a walking, a climbing, or a swimming animal. Predators need a different kind of model from prey, even though their worlds necessarily overlap. A monkey's brain must have software capable of simulating a three-dimensional maze of branches and trunks. A water boatman's brain doesn't need 3D software, since it lives on the surface of the pond in an Edwin Abbott flatland. A mole's software for constructing models of the world will be customized for underground use. A naked mole rat probably has world-representing software similar to a mole's, but a squirrel, although it is a rodent like a mole rat, probably has world-rendering software much more like a monkey's. The metaphor of middle world, of the intermediate range of phenomena that the narrow slit in our burqa permits us to see, applies to yet other scales or spectrums. We can construct a scale of improbabilities with a similarly narrow window through which our intuition and imagination are capable of going. At one extreme of the spectrum of improbabilities are those would-be events that we call impossible. Miracles are events that are extremely improbable. Evolution in middle world has ill-equipped us to handle very improbable events. But in the vastness of astronomical space or geological time, events that seem impossible in middle world turn out to be inevitable. Science flings open the narrow window through which we are accustomed to viewing the spectrum of possibilities. We are liberated by calculation and reason to visit regions of possibility that had once seemed out of bounds or inhabited by dragons. We've already made use of this widening of the window in Chapter 4, where we considered the improbability of the origin of life, and how even a near-impossible chemical event must come to pass given enough planet years to play with. And where we considered the spectrum of possible universes, each with its own set of laws and constants, and the anthropic necessity of finding ourselves in one of the minority of friendly places.
How should we interpret Haldane's queerer than we can suppose? queerer than can in principle be supposed, or just queerer than we can suppose, given the limitations of our brain's evolutionary apprenticeship in middle world? Could we, by training and practice, emancipate ourselves from middle world, tear off our black burqa, and achieve some sort of intuitive, as well as just mathematical, understanding of the very small, the very large, and the very fast? I genuinely don't know the answer, but I'm thrilled to be alive at a time when humanity is pushing against the limits of understanding. Even better, we may eventually discover that there are no limits. The God Delusion is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Random House Group. Copyright Richard Dawkins, 2006. Copyright in recording Random House Audiobooks.